So good evening everyone. It's quite amazing to see all of you in all your different locations, as well as those wonderful stalwart sitters in the Zendo at Wall Street. And thank you all. Thank you all for joining us for this very unusual sesshin during these uncertain times. Tonight is the regular night for Zen Yu, otherwise known as Young Urban Zen, who meet every Monday night. And so I want to welcome those folks, the Zen Yu folks, as well as any of you who weren't here last night for our opening, our sesshin opening. And any who have never been to any kind of sesshin before, let alone a strange one on Zoom. As most of you know, over the last 6 weeks, during our yearly practice period, we've been practicing with the paramitas, those qualities that we cultivate on the bodhisattva path. And we've practiced with the kind of short list of six that are emphasized in Mahayana Buddhism: generosity, ethical conduct, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. So this week during sesshin, we thought we would offer you some bonus paramitas from the long list, some of them from the long list, and some that we are just adding because we like them. But before I get to the one that I've chosen for this evening, I wanted to comment on Michael, the one Michael chose for his talk this morning, which many of you heard, but not all. He talked about a paramita that's not on the classic lists, but it's often in lists of virtues, you know, in various traditions, and it's restraint or renunciation. And he told a story that many of you heard about how he gave up coffee for a year after his mother's death, and what he discovered in doing that. So it raised a story in my mind, which I want to share. Some of you may have been wondering about my hair. Since Michael and I ordained 17 years ago, I've kept it short, and for two periods of time I shaved it. As you know, Buddhist monks and nuns have traditionally shaved their heads as a practice of renunciation, because hair has a sensual quality, doesn't it? It's nice to look at, it's nice to touch. And of course, Buddhist monks and nuns renounce sensual pleasure. So I've been doing a kind of inverse or double renunciation, renouncing the renunciation, since the pandemic began, and since, as I think many of you know, my mother died of COVID-19 on May 5th in her nursing home in Pennsylvania at the age of 96. She would have turned 97 last week. And like so many others around the world, I was unable to be with her in her last days and hours, or with my family to remember and celebrate her life. In some cultures, I believe women cut their hair in mourning. So I'm not cutting my hair in mourning. It's a visual, daily visual reminder of the duration of the pandemic and of my connection to my mom and to all those others whose loved ones have died in the pandemic. Maybe some of you, you know, so many of us in Vancouver, sort of in the Vancouver area, we were touched initially so lightly, and that we didn't even know anybody who caught the virus, let alone died of it. But, you know, many of my friends in the States either caught it themselves or knew someone who got very, very sick or died. So this was a conscious decision for me, made at a deeply intuitive level. Though I didn't kind of even realize COVID hair was a thing until Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's hair made the New York Times. At that point, my resolve wavered a bit. Never one to join in trends. But this practice of inverted renunciation is continuing to reveal insights to me. As Michael told you about his year of not drinking coffee, what it revealed to him. I've been reflecting on what parts of me I may have cut off along with my hair. We have to be very careful not to conflate renunciation with the silencing and disentitlement that we may have experienced as restricting. But that's another story. I move on to tonight's topic. We decided to include these short talks in this session, which has been done before at Loon Lake and also at Samish Island, the Red Cedar Zen community, our sister Sangha in Bellingham's yearly session. But we wanted to do it to kind of support a sense of connection and encouragement, because it's not easy to sit session all by yourself in your little home space. Even though you are connected here, and this is to remind you that you're sitting all together with all these other people that you see in the little rectangles. But if any of you really, really want to just sit zazen, you can turn me off, and I will probably not even know it. I thought I would start this part of my talk reviewing a little bit about what session is. Michael talked some this morning, and why we would do such a very strange thing as sitting in silence for a week doing nothing. It's very hard to explain session to someone who has no idea what it is. Have you, those of you who have been to session a number of times, is it always a little bit funny when you tell somebody you're going on a Zen retreat and they say, "Oh, that sounds so relaxing." And they think you're going to a spa, and you have to say, "Well, it's not exactly that." But how can you explain session? And I want to also talk a little bit about how we're adapting session to these unusual circumstances, and doing it in this really unprecedented way. As Michael mentioned last night, the word session is made up of two Chinese characters as pronounced in Japanese. Setsu meaning to touch or connect, and shin as the pictograph shows, which I'm going to show you now. Okay, so you see the word seshin, and then you see a more calligraphic representation of shin, which is showing the four-chambered heart. And shin in Chinese and Japanese means heart, mind, and spirit, which in Asian cultures are not split in the way they are in Western traditions. If you're in Japanese, if you're referring to the heart beating in your chest, you'll say shinzo, meaning heart organ. But this character alone is pronounced kokoro. Kokoro would have been the original Japanese pronunciation. Seshin comes from the Chinese pronunciation. These are words, pronunciations that came into Japanese upon contact with China, because Japan did not have a written language then. So hence it has become a really complicated language to learn. Kokoro has the sense of mind or spirit. In the Japanese dictionary, there are pages and pages of idioms that use this word. Kokoro no kate, food for thought, or spiritual nourishment. Kokoro no yami, the darkness of the heart, mind. Kokoro ni egaku, literally to draw or paint in one's mind, in other words, to visualize. Kokoro o awaseru, to unite one's mind with. So all those expressions are talking about heart and mind, spirit. Many of us have come to meditation practice thinking that it's all about clearing our minds of thoughts, right? Isn't that what you think? Or what you have thought? You're supposed to clear your mind of thoughts, right? But we then tend to think that our minds are located up here in our head. Not the case. So when we think of our mind as being located in our heads, we remain quite disconnected from what's going on in our bodies. But in reality, the mind is located throughout the body, intricately connecting our parts through the nervous system, which has particularly concentrated centers in our heart area and our belly. The ancient Eastern systems of yoga and meditation recognized this body-mind connection and refined it through direct observation and practice, right? Contemporary neuroscience is discovering what they discovered by direct observation thousands and thousands of years ago. This awareness of the body-mind connection is reflected in language, in the importance of the hara, you know, the belly center in Japanese, or the tantian in Chinese, as anyone who has practiced martial arts will know. And hara, the word hara in Japanese, can also mean mind. It's belly and it's also mind. So hara ga oki is large, means to have not a big belly, but to be generous and broad-minded. As does kokoro ga oki, big-hearted. So see, they overlap. Hara o kimeru means to make up your mind. To make up your belly, huh? It means to make up your mind. And so does kokoro o kimeru, to make up your mind. But those idioms using hara, or the belly, give more of what we might call a gut sense. The words carry a different valence. Hara ga tatsu, the belly rises or stands up, means to get angry. Did you know that we have a brain in our bellies? It's called our enteric nervous system, and it gives us what we refer to as our gut feelings. Andrea Olson, who wrote this beautiful and wonderful book called Body and Earth, an Experiential Guide, teaches what she calls experiential anatomy and does some wonderful body and sensory awareness exercises, like our Shuzo Kei has been offering us each Sunday. Here's what she has to say. The enteric nervous system is part, the enteric nervous system, or the brain in the gut, is composed of a primitive nervous system called the neural net within the lining of the digestive tract. So it goes through the esophagus, stomach, small intestines, and colon. This whole net of neurons, over 100 million neurons, making this up. And she says, the remarkable characteristic of this brain in the gut is that it can function autonomously, processing sensory information and maintaining homeostasis with little or no interaction with the brain up in the head or the spinal cord. Studies show that it can act independently, learn, remember, and feel. Each of us can recall situations where we followed our instincts or gut feelings. We made a phone call at the right moment, helped a friend, or met someone at an unexpected moment. Functioning below rational thought, our visceral body picks up on information that may not register in our conscious minds. This instinctive, in quotes, instinctive aspect engages another kind of intelligence and knowing, balancing our picture of ourselves as brainy and smart. In our daily lives, we can notice that when we engage all the dimensions of our nervous system, all of the dimensions of our nervous system potential, we feel supported by, rather than in conflict with, our deepest motivations. How about that? The brain in our belly, like the brain in our heads and the rest of our sympathetic nervous system, activates our fight, flight, or freeze response to threat. Sometimes it can save us, and sometimes it can deceive us, right? When our threat response goes into overdrive, based on previous experiences, usually called trauma, we misread our present situation. The threat response overrides our higher functions, like our good judgment, our attention, and our feelings of affiliation and caring. So here's where our practice, our meditation practice, comes in. It gives us the training to take a step back and bring awareness to body and mind, to breathe deeply, to activate what's called our parasympathetic nervous system, to calm. That calms and regulates our reactivity so that we can respond to changing situations with appropriate words and actions in our daily lives. If we give the word hara, you know, the belly, the Sino-Japanese reading, we could also call seshin seppuku, touching the belly mind, instead of touching the heart mind, touching the belly mind. I'm going to share screen again. Okay, so here we have seppuku. Seppuku touching the hara. I have just taken the great liberty of coining this new Japanese word. I don't know if this word exists. I don't think it does. And then I realized it turns out to be a pun. because there's so many similar Sino-Japanese readings, there you can pun a lot in Japanese. And it's a pun on seppuku, which you may know in its more colloquial reading as harakiri, or ritual disembowelment. Also pronounced as mangled in English as harikari. Now, I'm not just playing with words here. When we cut off awareness of our belly mind, we are figuratively committing seppuku, harakiri. We are disempowering the life energy of our hara. What if we were to touch our heart mind with kindness? What if we were to touch our belly mind with care? What if we were to touch our whole body mind with patient, all-inclusive attention? Our Shuso, Kakukokei, has generously encouraged us to practice with the paramitas, not just with intellectual understanding, but with embodied experience. So I'd like to offer you a practice you can try in the privacy of your home without being self-conscious, as you might be in the Zendo. If at any point in your zazen, in your meditation practice, you become aware of a feeling of unease or constriction in your heart area or your belly area, you might want to try simply placing one or both hands over that area and just rest there. Let your breathing be natural, non-forced, and just give your heart or your belly that care. If you'd like, you can try that now just for a few minutes. You don't feel you have to, but if you'd like, just one or both hands, wherever it feels like you'd like to give some care to your heart area or to your belly. And just to see how that feels. Or you can wait and try it later, if you wish. There may or may not be an emotional tone of fear or sadness or anger associated with this constriction that comes to us in the heart or the belly. There may or may not be thoughts or storylines that spin out from it. But when you do this, just allow your breath to breathe you and feel it as it is, staying present, not manipulating, just offering a caring presence to yourself, to your heart mind, to your belly mind, for as long as feels right. Sesshin gives us a safe container to stay with our own experience in a way that we don't typically do amid the distractions of daily life. We create a simplified environment and a schedule that carries us through the rhythms of the day, where we can gradually let our worries and preoccupations drop away and just do what's in front of us. The next thing on the schedule, whether that's zazen or kinhin or chopping carrots or serving tea or eating a meal or walking outdoors or standing and watching the light dance on the water of Loon Lake. In that simple structure of sesshin, we can refine and strengthen and deepen our attention. And we can release our constricted habit patterns and open to insight into the boundlessness of our true nature. But it's not easy. We are so used to distraction, right? When we have to stay in place and pay attention, We can feel like, let me out of here. Especially when, you know, we've gone to Sesshin. We're in for the duration. Let me out of here. What have I got myself into? But that commitment to stay the course holds us in place. And that's often where the shifts and the openings take place. I have lost track of how many sesshin I have done over almost 40 years of practice. But I've come to trust that at some point in sesshin, I will hit a wall. Some place where I'm stuck, some stubborn habit pattern or narrow view, and I'll just slam up against the wall, sometimes hard, sometimes not so hard. And I come to trust that at some point, that wall or one of those walls is just going to dissolve into spaciousness. And that's when I step through that gateless gate, right? There is nothing quite like sesshin. That's why it's so hard to explain to people, right? Now, certainly it's much easier when we're in a sesshin environment away from home, a quiet, natural setting, no, you know, ambulance sirens going down the street, our meals are taken care of, we don't see the piles of papers strewn around our house, on our desk. At Loon Lake in earlier years, there was no Wi-Fi or cell phone coverage to tempt us. To do sesshin like this on Zoom in the middle of the COVID pandemic, we have to use, now I'm finally getting to it, the paramita of upaya, skillful means. For that matter, negotiating and adapting to life in the pandemic over the last, 7 months has been a matter of upaya, skillful means. Upaya is one of the long list of 10, four additional ones. It added to the six that we've focused on. And we have mentioned it as we've gone along now and then because it weaves through all the paramitas. It's sometimes called skillful or sometimes compassionate means, and it helps us to temper the sort of all or nothing thinking that we can slip into when we're practicing the paramitas. Or any, you know, values. It helps us not go to extremes. We have to assess what is the most skillful and compassionate course to take in a particular time, a place, and situation. And we have to be prepared to reassess and adapt again and again, as we have been, you know, with the pandemic situation. In terms of your Zazen practice, upaya helps you assess when you have to strengthen your concentration using a breath awareness practice, or when you can sit with ease and spacious awareness of whatever arises and passes with each moment. When to stay with physical discomfort or even strong pain, noting how it arises and subsides, noting how it's affected by your own reactions to it and your stories you tell yourself about it. And when it's most skillful and compassionate to change your position, change to a position that supports stability and ease in the body so that you can sustain your practice through a whole week of sesshin. Upaya is not one size fits all. What's good for your practice right now is not necessarily what's good for someone else or what's good for you at some other time. In terms of your daily life, it's the same. Upaya helps you assess right speech, asking, is it true? Is it kind? Is it timely? Is it helpful? Upaya helps you know when to push through to get the job done, and when to let yourself rest deeply or take a break. It helps you assess when your friend needs you to help them think through a solution, and when they need you simply to stay present and listen with an open heart. Like the other paramitas, upaya does not stand alone. Upaya without generosity can become labored and resentful. Generosity without upaya can give the wrong gift at the wrong time. Upaya without the guidance of wisdom and compassion can degenerate into micromanagement or distraction. And without patience, upaya will burn out. So you see, and we've been seeing through all of these, the way these paramitas support each other, like this book, like Kay has given us the image of the spokes of a wheel. So what you'll be doing this week is putting together the elements of Sesshin the best you can, given your particular circumstances, to create that kokoro, the spirit of Sesshin. And we've modified the Sesshin schedule already by making fewer zazen periods and longer breaks. And as Michael mentioned last night, encouraging you to cook and eat in mindful silence, to limit time on your devices, or eliminate time on your devices, all those activities that stimulate busy mind. Getting outdoors is also really important. I don't think he mentioned that. One of the most lovely things about being at Loon Lake is waking up and walking to the Zendo first thing in the morning and seeing the sun come through the mist on the lake and seeing the surface of the lake change with the rain and the wind and the moon emerging from the clouds at night. So I want to suggest one more practice you can do as part of your Sesshin, if you wish, is to step outdoors into your yard, or even it's only onto your balcony or your deck, first thing in the morning and last thing before you go to bed at night. Even just for just a few minutes to stand or sit and just open your senses to the early morning and to the night. So this week, please be guided by upaya. Michael talked last week, and Kay on Sunday talked about the paramita of wisdom, prajna. And Michael mentioned Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who rides on a lion with his sword to cut through delusion. The bodhisattva archetype of upaya is Samantabhadra, Arshuso K's favorite, who rides on an elephant, a white elephant, or several white elephants, often with multiple hands, each holding a different tool to help out suffering beings. In Zen language, in the figurative language of Zen, prajna and upaya, wisdom and skillful means, are the head and tail of our practice. Long ago, a monk asked Zen master Chufeng, "What about when there's a head but no tail?" In other words, wisdom but no skillful means. Chufeng replied, "Well, the head alone is not sublime." "What about when there's a tail but no head?" the monk asked. And Chufeng said, "You try your utmost, but you have no power." Wisdom without skillful minds is not as sublime as we might wish. Skillful means without wisdom might be strenuous, but it has no power or depth. We could ask a further question. What if there's a head or a tail, but no heart? Or no belly? No kokoro, no hara. What's your answer? So please, don't forget to attend to your heart this session. Don't forget to attend to your belly. Now, don't forget your feet either. During this session, please connect, touch with kindness and curiosity your head and tail and everything in between. With creativity, with ease and joy, and be nourished and refreshed. You can deeply trust this practice for the long haul. So I have gone over time. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your practice. Let us chant the refuges together to end the evening.